Let's
talk a little bit about Lexington. What were the hangouts in Lexington when you were young, and did students come up to the local places?
Yes, students did, I'm sure. And I'm glad to think that one of the hangouts when I was, I guess it was even before I got to college, was a place called Mike's Place. You've probably heard some other people talk about that. Mike's Place was a little a night spot located right on the corner of the road that goes into the golf club. The building is still there. It's apartments, some sort of apartments now, and they've added other units to it. But at that time, it was the main night spot young people went out to. And Mike was a real character. He had a little zoo, I think, that went along with it. Had some animals, and but the nightclub or night spot or whatever was where we all went. And I think he had a jukebox, you know, and we danced and had booze all around the place. And that's the main place that I remember. There were other places that came and went.
So this was out on South Main?
Uh-huh.
I've never heard of Mike's. That's a brand new one to me.
Oh, yeah. That was a big local spot back in those days.
Boy, you think any photos have survived of that?
I wonder. Because he was around here for a long time, and they would get him to bring his animals out for things, you know, like the mock convention parade and that sort of thing.
Yeah, who was he?
His name was Mike Brown.
Mike Brown.
Uh-huh. And
that's a new one on me.
Really, uh-huh. But then there were things downtown. There was, of course, there was the Liquid Lunch. Have you heard about?
No. Yeah. This is great. What's the Liquid Lunch?
The Liquid Lunch was down where McCamel Inn is now on the main floor, and that went through a number of names, but that was just strictly a beer joint, pretty much, and that wasn't the official name of it. I can't remember what the official name was, but that's what everybody called it. And then there was Jabbo's, which was where the Wilson Walker House is. Jabbo Morris, he provided everybody with beer, pretty much. He delivered beer at W&M, BMI, and he had his place down there.
And it was a restaurant?
It was really just a beer joint, I guess we'd call it, just a place where he could go in and drink beer. And he must have had a restaurant, too, because I think the ABC laws have probably always required that you had to serve some food where you serve beer or wine or whatever. But then another big place was Doc's Corner Store. I know you've heard about it. You haven't heard about that?
The Corner Store. Charlie was telling me a little about
that.
Yeah,
Charlie would remember the Corner
but
Store.
But it was called Doc's?
Doc Collette. Now, I don't know what Doc's first real name was, but his last name was Collette, something like
that. Right, now, where was that located?
Well, that was right there on the corner where the post office is. Across from the post office where the quick print place is, Quality
uh-huh.
Quick Print. Collette was a character for years. And that was, when I was in school here, that was really the big beer drinking place, where he just had booze in the counter there. And he supposedly served food, as all those places did. And the ABC people were just not nearly as strict as they are now about underage drinking. Of course, I guess the age was a little younger then too, maybe. But Doc's was just an institution. They had a fire there one time, I remember, and Doc's poor little dog got burned up, I think. Mm-hmm. And that was a great source of consternation for quite a while. But he operated that place for a good many years. But it was in its heyday in those post-war years when when I was here. Then there was a place down at the Dutch Inn for a while, kind of bar or whatever down there. And you know where that is on Washington mm-hmm. Street there? And I can't remember what they called that exactly. That was in business for a while. So those were the main places. And then the fraternities were just very much a center of that sort of thing, social activity for the college age crowd.
So today we're a real magnet for tourists. Were tourists coming through?
Tourists were coming through then, not nearly in the numbers that they are now, but tourists have always come through for a long, long time on account of the Lee Jackson graves and the Lee connection with the college here and so forth. And of course, there was always a certain amount of travel through here on account of the colleges, people coming and going for the colleges.
And I wonder, weren't people coming through just because it was a major intersection?
Yes. It was when 11 and 60 crossed right there on the main corner of town, there was a certain amount of travel that just came through because of two major highways.
I came across a reference recently to their finishing paving Route 60,
uh-huh.
and that they were almost done paving all the way to Stanton.
Right.
And I just thought, oh my God, I guess there was a time when it wasn't paved.
Yeah. Oh. Well, there was a time when Lexington was very isolated travel-wise, really. When Lee was here, it was extremely isolated. Of course, at that time, the canal was still in operation. Later on, people just despaired about getting in and out of Lexington. And at one time, the best way to get in and out of Lexington was take the stagecoach through Goshen Pass and catch the train in Goshen. You can imagine what that trip through Goshen Pass in those days must have been like by stagecoach. So it was, travel was not good.
Yeah, I came across a reference where it talked about the various ways, this is about 1850, various ways to get in and out of Lexington, and it said, whichever way you chose, you wished you'd chosen the other
That's
way.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was a real good quote.
Yeah.
Now, it's something you've alluded to a couple of times and is fast upon us, is the mock convention.
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, that's certainly been a great tradition at W&L, and that thrust for authenticity has been true going way back. It has become more scientific in recent years, and I'm sure, and they've probably been in closer touch with all the party functionaries and so forth to try to get an authentic feel for it, but I was in school, and of course, for the one in 48, and that was one we missed, I believe. I'll have to go back and look. But there was a real push for authenticity. The mock convention has also historically attracted very prominent politicians here, including President Truman and, of course, former Vice President Alvin Barkley, who died here. That was, of course, a thing that focused a lot of attention on it. Bill Clinton, of course, spoke here when he was governor. Carter, before he became president. Just a lot of Goldwater. Just many, many really very high-profile political figures have come here, and it's been taken fairly seriously by people in the political sphere, I think.
So you've covered mock conventions not only as a student, but as a newspaper man.
Yeah, sure. sure have.
So you've got a real continuum. Describe what that's been like through the years. How has Mock Convention evolved in your time, in your life here in Lexington?
Well, it's one thing that has really had a pretty steady course through the years, it seems to me, in my time. Now, I can't speak for what it was like before World War II, but ever since the war, the 40s, it's been pretty much what it is today, although it I'm sure is more of a production that was nothing like the money spent on all of this in those days, of course, that there is now. But even in those times, they had coverage in Life magazine, which was a big thing, you know, and this sort of thing. It's certainly remained a strong tradition and very much what it is today, really, over those years.
I'm intrigued that the students are able to entice these big name people here. How do they do it?
I don't know. I think they do it lots of times by political pull of one kind or another. Now, for instance, I remember when Jimmy Carter came up here, at that time he was governor of Georgia, I guess, my friend Dick Denny, who was somehow connected with Carter, maybe in the state administration or whatever, in Georgia, got him to come up here, I'm sure. He was a WNL alumnus. And I'm sure lots of times it's just through some sort of connections. I don't know how they got Newt Gingrich to come this time. I'll believe he's here when he gets here, because I think it's mighty hard for a man like that to break loose. Historically, the people they've gotten have been people who either have been in top political office or have not yet arrived at top political office. It's very unusual to have people like Gingrich who are right in the thick of it at this time. That really is something different, and I'm going to be interested to see whether it'll work out.
Me too. Well, I'm kind of curious whether they say, well, you know, Jimmy Carter was nobody when he came to Mock Convention, and after Mock Convention, look what happened. And yeah. The same thing with Clinton. I mean, I wonder if they don't have some line they use.
I don't know. Well, they might. They might have something that they use to help. I'm sure they use everything they can to entice them here. One of the real challenges of the Mock Convention through the years has been to kind of keep the lid on student high spirits, you know, with a few beers flowing here and there and so forth. People just get in high spirits and fall off floats and that sort of thing, you know. But and also they sometimes have to be encouraged a little bit to tone down some of the floats, because the school kids get out of school to watch the parade, you know, and so forth.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. They do. Will this year, I think. That's been one thing. I had a good time just this spring. My son has a little magazine that he gets out for the tourism business here, sort of Lexington, you know, for the travel industry, and he asked me to do a little piece for it on the history of the Mock Convention, and I had a real good time going back through the files of the paper and looking at those stories I'd written all those years ago, you know, and remembering some of the things. But one of the funny things was the time that Truman spoke. Some of the politicians had a real good sense of what this was all about and how it was, you wanted to really get into the swing of it and make this a real convention speech, you know. But some others haven't quite gotten the drift of it as well, and they've undertaken to kind of lecture the students, you know, you young men should, you know, and so forth. And this, that doesn't go over well at all. And I think maybe Truman was a little bit that way, and the crowd got a little bit restive, and this one guy, in a quiet moment in the Rivers Gym, he just rolled this beer can down the aisle, and you could just hear that thing clanging down the aisle. It was very embarrassing to all the W&L authorities and so forth, but this is the kind of thing that they've had to contend with, of course. But through it all, the leadership, the student leadership of the Mock Convention has really done a wonderful job in keeping it to its purpose and keeping the hijinks within bounds, and the demonstrations on the floor, kind of keeping them within reason and so forth.
That's a pretty good description. I think that's just great. Now, a couple of times you've made mention of the hijinks, the beer drinking, the drear binking, I started to say, the beer drinking. And you've watched this both as a student and probably participated a little as a student, but as a newspaperman following the town-gown relationship through the years. What have you observed? What does Washington and Lee have a drinking problem?
Well, I'm sure it does, as does every college campus. It's gone through phases, I think. I remember when I went down to teach at Macaulay Prep School down in Chattanooga, after I finished here, I met one of the Mr. McCauley, Messrs. McCauley, he had gone to Washington Lee, and he told me he would never send a son of his here because they drank so at Washington Lee. I came home and mentioned that to my father, and he said, "Well, that man never drew a sober breath the whole time he went to W&L." So I think your point of view changes, you know, sometime from the time you're a student to the time you're older and so forth. And there have been problems with drinking, of course, and parties and that sort of thing. I think that there's a lot more recognition now of the danger of alcohol abuse than it was in my day. We thought it was just funny when somebody got drunk. Now they are beginning to recognize that, you know, the beginnings of an alcohol problem when they see one and so forth. I think that people are much more aware, even young people in school, than we were. And I can't say that the problem is any worse than it was then, if it's bad now. The fraternities, of course, now are equipped with these party rooms that handle the noise and all, and the drinking, so that it doesn't spill out on the streets as much as it used to.
What about that period when it was spilling out on the streets? What was it like covering that in the paper?
Well, I think people in college towns are just reasonably tolerant of that sort of thing. They've been through it before, and they realize the college scene is important to the community, and so I don't recall that it's ever spilled out to the extent of it's being a really very serious problem. One of the most annoying problems with it has been the litter problem of, you know, paper cups and all strewn up and down the streets after a Saturday night party. And that's annoyed me greatly because I like the town. I don't like to see it littered like that. But that's a problem that they've tried to deal with one way or the other.
How does it get
better? I think it's better. I don't think it's as bad as it used to be.
Now, how about, you mentioned what was going on here in the 60s? What did go on here in the 60s?
Well, very much the same thing that went on in so many campuses. The real division in our society over the Vietnam War and the prominent part that students played everywhere in the protest of the war. And it seemed to some people that it was just going to be the end of civilization. The students were just going to destroy everything, you know, like the Red Guard in China. And I remember one very tense moment at Washington. You've probably come across this sometime in talking to people when Bob Huntley was president during that time. I hope you'll talk to him at some point.
I'm waiting for him to get back from Florida.
Yeah, but things reached a kind of a crescendo, and the students were threatening to close this college down, I think, that spring. And what year that is, I would have to go back and look. But, and there was a real counterculture type of student who had gotten to be head of the student body, I guess, and he was making demands and so forth. And they finally, the thing sort of came to a head with this outdoor meeting on the front campus lawn there in front of Lee Chapel. They put up a podium there, and Bob Huntley addressed the students and did what I thought was a masterful job. I went over to hear him, and I thought he handled the situation very well and seemed to sort of diffuse the thing. That they didn't make good on their threat to shut down the school. And I can't remember what all the demands were that they had, but I remember being feeling that he had really handled it very well. And from that point on, that seemed to be the passing of the worst of the crisis at Washington Lee. But it changed life on the campus for all time. There's no question about it. And that Vance Address thing was just one little manifestation of it, I'm sure. And I know the curriculum underwent certain changes, and various things were changed. And I'd have to go back and sort of refresh my memory on all that. But life was different there, just as it was everywhere after that period, you know. I'd be interested in hearing what Bob's recollections of that were. Bob Huntley, that was a terribly stressful time to be a college president. Our friend Edgar Shannon, who was president of the University of Virginia at the same time, and of course he's a WNL alumnus and would be a
he's on my list too.
Good person to talk to also. And he underwent that over there, and it was just an experience that would age a man.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very nerve-wracking.
Do you know why? This is an off-the-wall question, but it's satisfying my curiosity. Do you know why Red Square is called Red Square?
I'm not sure that I do, really. It's been called that ever since I can remember.
So it goes back to when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think it goes back to about the time those fraternities were built in the 30s. And I think it just has to do with the fact that those red brick fraternities were built in a square.
Well, I wondered if it's that simple.
I think so.
An answer.
I think it is.
It's kind of a loaded name, you know.
I know. Yeah, it sure is. It sounds like it has some very sinister connotations.
It does. And I've always, you know, it's been a question I've been meaning to ask people, but it never seems like it's appropriate.
Yeah.
But I thought you, as the newspaper man, might have tracked down, might know the answer to that. Now, you mentioned that you were classmates. You weren't exactly classmates with Roger Mundt, right?
No, Roger was a year behind me. Roger was in 50, I think.
Right.
But we were good friends. He was a Delt, and the Delts and the SAEs went back and forth quite a lot together.
Now, Washington and Lee has produced some pretty impressive alumni, and Roger Mundt being one of them.
Yeah.
What was it like going through with somebody like that? Did you have any inkling of who he was going to be. Now, Tom Wolfe was the same time period,
Tom
too,
Wolfe was
right?
a little later. Tom Wolfe was came along about, oh, 6 or 7 years. Maybe not quite that much.
Not
later.
That much.
He was a little later, though.
51 or 52, I think.
Was he that?
I think so. Because
I didn't remember that we
maybe
had overlapped. He was in school with my brother, who finished in 54. At WL. Roger was a colorful character at Washington Lee, and he was obviously destined for something good. He really didn't know what he wanted to do when he got out of school, and I hope you get to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
He had a real sense of the dramatic, and they used to have these performances on campus to raise money for what they called the Student War Memorial Scholarship Fund. This was after, in the years after the war, they'd have a big production almost every year, and I remember Roger was in that one year, and he was playing the role of Dr. White, the university physician, and except they called him Mr. White. They just did everything they could to irritate the powers that be, And Roger, he just wowed him on stage. I remember he got this hypodermic needle and ran all the way across the room to jam it into somebody, and he had some real good lines in that. He had this booming voice as he does now, and he was obviously a person who was going to make himself known later on.
And were there people? I mean, I don't mean to name names, but were there people that you thought were going to develop into something that nothing, you never heard from them again? I mean, you know, there's sort of that feeling as you're going through college that certain people are going to be something special.
I'm sure there were, because I remember even in high school when you would have the most outstanding and so forth and the most likely to succeed and the annual, and they'd never be heard from again. Those particular ones would never amount to anything, So you certainly couldn't always tell.
Now, when you were there, and for until relatively recently, Washington and Lee was a male bastion, if ever there was one.
Yeah.
Where did the girls come from?
Oh, they all came from the girls' colleges around, Sweetbriar and Hollins and Randolph Macon and Mary Baldwin and Southern Sam.
Now, did they come to you or did you go to them? What were the logistics of?
Well, the logistics of it was that you went for them. They would not come to you. You went to them, you went and you picked up your date and you squired her, or a friend would go and pick up maybe several dates or something like that. Sometimes they'd come on the train. I remember the train days were pretty well over by the time I was in school, but I remember it may have been a fancy dress when a bunch of them came up on the train because of a big snow or something. I can't remember all the details of it, but.
So, do you remember the train station still being functioning?
The train station in my time was definitely past its heyday. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was not really.
It wasn't a passenger terminal anymore?
They had passenger service here until about the mid-1950s, but nobody ever used it. They had a little car that was half a passenger car and half a baggage car or something.
Really?
And it rolled back and forth between here and Glasgow. Balcony Falls, they called it.
So it was just a spur? It wasn't on the main line?
No, it wasn't. never was on the main line here. The B&O was coming down the valley from Winchester and Harrisonburg and Stanton, heading for Salem, which was then more prominent than Roanoke. It got as far as Lexington. And meanwhile, the railroad that became the N&W did an end run, came down through Buena Vista and took the river right, which was a much easier route, and got to Roanoke, and that pretty well cut off the B&O. So we never were really on a through rail line here. People to go from Lynchburg, I remember hearing my mother-in-law talk about coming to Mary Baldwin from Lynchburg. She would take the train from Lynchburg to Balcony Falls, that's in Glasgow, take another train from Balcony Falls to Lexington, and changing in, and take another train to Stanton. It was an all-day trip.
Well, you know, I found these references to how long it took to get from Clifton Forge to Lexington by train, and it was like 4 hours.
Yeah.
And I wondered, what on earth were they doing all that time?
Oh, I don't know. You probably had to change, you see. You get to Clifton Forge, from Clifton Forge to Lexington, you could come to Balcony Falls and then take another train up to Lexington, or you could go to Stanton and take a train down the valley to Lexington. So it was not real convenient there.
So by the time you were a student, the car had pretty much taken over?
The car had really taken over. Now, back in the 20s and 30s and before that, the people did travel in and out by train. They'd have special trains and excursion trains and trains that would come in for the football games and that sort of thing, you know. But by the time I was in school, that was really past.
And how about buses? Were buses? Did students travel by bus?
Students did travel by bus, yeah. Mm-hmm. They did.
Now, I've seen a picture, and I don't know whether it's students or faculty or whom, but of a lot of people leaving for World War II behind McCrum's.
Uh-huh.
That's where the bus station was?
That's where the bus station was at one time.
Do you remember
time.
That? Were you there
oh, yeah.
to see those people?
I don't remember being there to see that group off, but the bus station was at McCrum's for quite a long time. Yeah, that was, I don't know just how many years, but quite a long time. Yeah, there was a lot of bus travel then.
Yeah, I guess you were a little young to be. You were probably in school the day everybody took off.
Yeah. I didn't get into service until just about the end of the closing months of the war, really.
Well, your timing was real good.
It certainly was. Excellent.
Well, I've asked you just about all the questions and gotten wonderful, succinct answers. Is there anything you'd like to talk about Washington and Lee or Lexington or the relationship?
Well, it's just been wonderful to me to live here and to be a W&L alumnus and to live in the town and enjoy all the wonderful advantages that you get to enjoy in a college town. I think one of the greatest people for Washington Lee was Dr. Laborn, and I hope that this will come out in some of the interviews about what he did for the academic quality of the school.
Tell me about that.
Well, he came here from Yale, you know, as dean, and offered what he called but it became known as the Laborn Plan because he wanted wanted people to be able to equate Washington Lee with Ivy League schools, and he certainly greatly strengthened the curriculum and the academic quality of the school, I'm sure, and just his own wonderful learning and his marvelous interest in the students and everything that he meant in so many different ways has had a tremendous impact. He personally had a great impact on a lot of students who just practically worshiped the ground he walked on. And he wasn't as popular among the alumni of the day because they blamed him for the problems of de-emphasis in athletics and so forth, I think. Well, he had said some things that maybe left him a little open for criticism, the alumni. But I think he stands out as being a very important person in the history of the school. On another level, I hope you'll ask about the Gauley Bridge Hunt Club. That was a funny thing that that was active right after the war. And I don't, I never was a member of the Gauley Bridge Hunt Club. I think it was
what's the word you're saying?
Gauley Bridge. That's the name of a little place in West Virginia on Route 60 in West Virginia between here and Charleston.
And how do you spell it?
Gauley Bridge. Two words. And that was, you'll have to ask Charlie McDowell or Pat Robinson about that.
All right.
It was just a fun kind of a drinking thing as much as anything else. But you'll have to ask them about Colonel John McWhorter, who was a real big person in that. But it was just something that people laughed about and had a good time about. And I guess it arose from some trip that people took to Charleston one time or something, and they probably stopped in Gauley Bridge for a beer or something. But they had this, they'd march around, they had this outfit, they would wear something. It was just one of those funny things, like the Whitefriars and Pan, Pyrophanew, those.
There are a lot of those kind of things around here. I don't know much about them. I've just seen pictures in the Calyx.
No, they were just clubs of people that it was just a social thing and didn't amount to a whole lot. Pretty much, but there were more serious things, of course, like the debating groups and things like that.
Well, they certainly are. It's an organized school, whatever there was.
Isn't it full of organizations? Well, I think I have bored you for long enough, and I've enjoyed.
You have not bored me at all. This has been a wonderful interview, just as Frank promised.
Well, I'm glad if it could be of some help, because it's been fun doing it.
Well, I didn't know a thing about the Gauley Bridge Hunt Club until today, so that's, you sent me off on a new tack. We'll see what comes of it.
Yeah, I don't think much will come of it, but...
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome.